presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about the second task. Welcome, everybody, to episode 39 of First Years. Today, we are going over chapters 26 and 27. So we're going to dive right in, and this episode might jump around a little bit because I have a lot of questions to pose to you guys, but I'm going to do my best to go chronologically through these two chapters, but we get information about the same characters in both chapters, so I might jump around here and there. But last we left off, Harry was figuring out his clue in the prefect's bathroom, and he had an incident in the hallway where he almost got caught by Snape, Filch, and Moody. So this chapter starts out with Harry relaying that entire story to Ron and Hermione. And I love this scene because it just struck me to just appreciate the complete chaos of this moment around them, where they're in charms class, they're learning how to banish objects, there's pillows flying everywhere, everybody's hitting each other while Harry's relaying this really important information and this story of Snape and Moody and all the weird things that sort of went on in that moment. But it's also a really good scene because, of course, when there's like chaos going around, no one is really going to overhear you. They're going to be distracted by everything else. No one's going to listen in. So it's actually very smart. But one of the things in these chapters that we had started to speak about at the end of last episode was Snape and Moody implying that Snape isn't trustworthy and that Dumbledore gives second chances and maybe he shouldn't. And I posed the question to you guys whether or not you guys think that Snape is behind everything that has happened so far in this book. But Hermione makes a really good point. She points out that they made Snape the villain all first year, and it did turn out that he was protecting them the entire time. So with that in mind, does that change your thoughts about what I asked last episode or not? Because yes, Snape does not like Harry, and we'll talk more about that later. But at the same time, he did help Harry or saved Harry's life in book one, and they were completely wrong about him being after the Sorcerer's Stone. So do you think this is a similar situation? The other thing I wanted to point out in this conversation is that there's a bunch of different moving parts, which I really like, and I feel like there's so many people to keep track of and also so many people's opinions to take into account. And I really think it boils down to, do you trust Dumbledore's judgment or do you trust Moody's judgment? Now, we've known Dumbledore for much longer than we have Moody, but Moody has made a very big impression in this book, I think. So are you leaning more toward Dumbledore, who gives people second chances, or Moody, who doesn't seem to trust other people? And one of the things that really stood out to me also in this moment is Harry's line where he's wondering what Snape did with his first chance if he's on his second one. And I thought that was such a good question to ask. And I was like, oh my God, you're so right, because it's not just about giving someone a second chance, right? There has to be a reason to give them a second chance. That means they probably blew their first one. And I'm so interested to know what you think Snape did that ruined his first chance that Dumbledore had to give him a second one. We also get information about Crouch and that he really hasn't been showing up to work. We also see that with the headlines that Sirius shares with us later on in these two chapters. And so why do you think Crouch would be pretending to be ill, if he is pretending to be ill, when he's well enough to be at Hogwarts to sneak into Snape's office? Or do we think he's actually ill? And the thought occurred to me that maybe he was in Snape's office because he needed to get something to help whatever illness he has. But if that's the case, he probably could have just asked Snape, no? I would assume Snape would help out a ministry official if he needed it. So there's definitely something that just doesn't sit quite right with me with him being at Hogwarts after dark and in Snape's office. So Harry has figured out what the clue is, and then his next problem is figuring out what to do about that clue and how he's going to survive underwater for an hour. It struck me that my big question here is, why is it so hard to find information in the Hogwarts library? I feel like anytime they're searching for information, they come up with nothing. They can never find what they're actually looking for. Why is that? Because you would think, like, I in college, I have gone to ask librarians for help to search for information for essays I was writing, and they were so helpful at helping me, like, search for the right books and, you know, nail down my search terms and really figure out, like, a way to get the information that I actually needed. And the fact that something to breathe underwater has to exist, and the fact that it is so hard to find in the Hogwarts library, that Harry doesn't find any single mention of Gillyweed or Bubblehead Charm or anything like that, it's astounding to me that he can't find it. I'm so curious as to how this library is organized, or what kind of books are actually getting published in the wizarding world that makes it so difficult that these topics aren't being written about. Why do you think that is? But thankfully, Dobby is there to save the day. He manages to find Gillyweed, and he wakes Harry up 10 minutes before the task is about to start, and Harry is sprinting through Hogwarts to get to the lake. And Percy is there, and he's kind of a jerk when he arrives, like, scolding Harry about, like, him being, like, there at the last minute, which I did not think was very fair. So Harry takes Gillyweed, and he immediately takes on some fish-like qualities to help him move through the water. So were you wondering about how gills work? Because I was. So let's talk about it. This is how the Ocean Conservatory website explained it. So gills are obviously what fish use to breathe. They also breathe in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide like we do. So the gills are organs, and they have capillaries in them, which are blood vessels. And when the water runs over the gills, the capillaries pick up the oxygen that's in the water, and the blood delivers the oxygen to the body, which I thought was really cool. What else is really cool about this task is that we have a task within a task. We have Harry not just has to navigate the lake, but he also, and the merpeople that are in the lake, but he also has to face off against a couple of Grindylows. And it reminded me of one of our previous episodes where we had Jess on, and we asked, why didn't Harry ask Lupin for help with the first task? And Grindylows are something that I know that Lupin taught the previous year. So I thought it was a really great detail to include, and a really great callback to Lupin, because we know he taught them about how to get past Grindylows. Not only that, but in our episode where we covered the first task, we had talked about that a dragon is usually like the final battle in a lot of stories. And in this book, it's the first. And so the tasks can only get harder from here. And that also struck me, that Harry isn't just facing one thing in this task. He's facing multiple things in this task. So it's not just one dragon that he needs to face. Now it's, okay, here's the lake, and here are merpeople, and here are Grindylows, and you're also going to have to find your way through. So let's talk about mermaids. I was very excited to get to this episode. So on page 497 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, the merpeople are described as, "The merpeople had grayish skin and long, wild, dark green hair. Their eyes were yellow, as were their broken teeth, and they wore thick ropes of pebbles around their necks," which is very different from how we see mermaids portrayed in other popular stories and legends, right? A lot of times mermaids are drop-dead gorgeous. So if you will, come join me on a mermaid deep dive. So mermaids and the idea of half-human, half-fish creatures have been around for thousands of years. We've even seen gods in various religions depicted as looking like merfolk. And honestly, it can be said that as early as we started to explore the ocean and notice sea creatures, that this is where mermaids started to appear in our stories and our legends. They're associated with misfortune and death, and they lure sailors off course and cause shipwrecks. And mermen are also associated with summoning storms, sinking ships, and drowning sailors. And this idea actually connects them to the sirens in Greek mythology, and those creatures are actually half bird, half woman, and they would lure sailors away by singing. We have many stories about merpeople throughout history. I read about a group off the coast of Scotland that would challenge captains to rhyming contests, and if the captains won, they would be spared. And also, I read about an account of a mermaid entering Holland and needing to be nursed back to health before she assimilated into society. Some people think that manatee sightings are actually the basis of the mermaid stories, because when you see them from a distance, they can fool people into thinking it was a different creature. Because really, when you see a sea creature in the water, you're not seeing the entire animal, you're just seeing a part of it. There was also a myth that I stumbled across that Alexander the Great's sister turned into a mermaid after dying, and when ships would pass through her region of the ocean, she would ask sailors if he was still alive, and if they answered yes, she would allow them to pass, she would calm the waters so they could sail through, otherwise she would conjure up a storm and kill everybody. Another one of the earliest legends or myths is that Atargatis, who is an Assyrian fertility goddess, threw herself into a lake after she accidentally killed her lover and turned into a fish from the waist down. Pliny the Elder also wrote about mermaids to the point where people legitimately thought they were as real as any other animal. He also said that they would drown humans, which played into their bad reputation. Sailors really had to be on the lookout because there were stories that mermaids would sing to them and try to lure them into crashing, or they would try to board their ships. Other stories also said that mermaids were actually ghosts of young women that had died tragically. And the concept of mermaids went beyond just stories. Sailors would use maps that had the locations of mermaids and other monsters labeled on their map so they could avoid them. In the 16th century, there was a map called Carta Marina, which was made by somebody named Olaus Magnus, that had everything on it that these sailors would want to avoid. So when we look at the symbolism of mermaids, it's similar to the two different versions that we tend to see depicted in media. So we see the really nice, beautiful ones, like in Disney's The Little Mermaid, and then we also see these darker, more sinister ones, which are the ones that we see in the live-action Peter Pan and also the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. So the symbolism follows that. They're known to symbolize fertility and life in the ocean, but also storms and destruction and disaster. And if we think about it, they reflect the ocean pretty well, because that can be beautiful and lovely, or disastrous and chaotic. And so sailors would often put mermaid figureheads at the front of their ships as a way to appease the sea and help them get to where they were going and back safely. So compare all of that to the mermaids that we see in this book, who don't really seem super friendly, but they also don't seem like the type to try to crash ships or anything. You know, Harry doesn't actually have to, like, fight them. They're not trying to drown him. And perhaps this is because wizards do have magic. You know, maybe wizards wouldn't be fooled, or they can defend themselves better than muggles can. So do you think if some, like, non-wizards were in the lake, they would suffer at the hands of the merfolk, or no? So Harry gets through this task. He's the first one to reach the people that were taken from the champions, but he takes the song very seriously. So he's the last one to reach the surface. And what do we think this task tested? Was it determination? Is it loyalty? Is it working under pressure with a time limit? Because even though they weren't actually going to lose these people that were closest to them, they wanted the champions to really believe that. So that has to matter. And when they're awarding Harry his points for bringing multiple people back, they talk about that it's due to his determination to return all hostages to safety, which speaks to Harry's Gryffindor-ness, if you ask me. So do you think this is a determination task? And maybe the last one was a thinking on your feet and daring task. And this one is, yeah, determination and a working under pressure task. So Harry ends up tied with Cedric. And jumping back to Snape for just a moment, we see this moment in potions class where Snape is really going out of his way to put Harry down and try to get a rise out of him. And he accuses him of being the one to steal from Snape's supplies of potion ingredients because that's where the gillyweed came from. And Snape is determined to prove that Harry is a thief. And he talks about a new potion that we haven't heard about before, which is called Veritaserum, which is a truth-telling potion that is extremely powerful. And he says it's strictly controlled by the Ministry. Yet, he's willing to break the rules and use it on Harry, which I'm sure has to be not just against school rules, but I'm sure it's illegal. But Snape doesn't care. He's more than willing to put himself on the line to prove that Harry is as bad as he has always said he is. And to make things even more sketchy in this scene, Karkaroff comes into Snape's class to tell him that they need to talk. And Harry very cleverly eavesdrops, but I feel like if this really needed to be a private conversation, that Karkaroff probably should have made sure that all of the students had left the classroom before saying anything. But he talks to Snape about something, again, that has never been more clear, and he shows him something on his forearm. So what do you think that's about? We get more information about Snape and also Crouch later on in these chapters when we go to meet Sirius in Hogsmeade. And so we go over all of the information that we know about the Triwizard situation. So Sirius thinks that someone in the top box of the Quidditch World Cup took Harry's wand. We also learn that Crouch isn't someone who usually takes off of work, and yet he seems to just, like, not show up to things after initiating them, like the World Cup and also the Triwizard Tournament. And then we find out something huge. We find out that Crouch is the one that sent Sirius to Azkaban without a trial. And I think this brings us into a really interesting discussion about motivations and morals and what the best way to handle things is. Because Crouch is anti-Voldemort, which is good, but he used his power to deny people trials, to allow Aurors to kill rather than capture, and to allow the use of unforgivable curses on suspects. Now, if we just unpack that a little bit, we have seen all of the unforgivable curses be used in Moody's classroom. And Crouch has allowed, or had allowed, those to be used on suspects. Not necessarily people who were found guilty, and I'm not saying that that would be better, but just to really hone in on suspects, which means that people could have been tortured with some of these curses without any evidence against them, because his paranoia was so high. And it sounds like during that time, it was very hard to determine who was innocent and who wasn't. Also, he has fundamentally thrown out human rights of being given a fair trial before you are sentenced to life in not just prison, but like the worst prison in the world, where you have dementors literally sucking the life out of you. And it just reminded me of the situation that we are facing today with policing and violence and the mentality of shoot first, ask questions later. And I want to hear your guys' perspective on what you took away from that information as well, where Harry Potter will always connect to our world, as we've talked about many times before, and we've focused specifically on in previous episodes. So what do you think about the Wizarding World, given that information that we've learned, where someone in a position of power, who isn't even the minister, but is the head of law enforcement, can just make these rules and nobody's there to stop him to be like, hey, wait, no, actually, you can't just throw this person in jail without a trial. Like, they deserve to have a trial. And no, you should probably not use the unforgivable curses on anybody, but I think that's a whole other debate, but especially on people who you don't know if they're a follower of Voldemort's or not. And maybe don't let your auras bring people in dead and try to bring them in alive. You know, what does that say about like a respect of humanity, even in the worst people in the world? Like, these people that follow Voldemort and are part of this terrible time in the Wizarding World. And even Moody, who hates dark wizards, is someone who we'd learn in this chapter always tried to bring people back in alive. I think there's a very interesting and in-depth discussion we can have here about how the Wizarding World has been run and was allowed to run at a time, and also what we're seeing in our own world today. And I'm going to pivot to Snape again, and this will be my last point for this episode, is that we learn from Sirius more about Snape, that Snape knew curses as soon as he arrived at school. And he hung around a group of people that all ended up being Death Eaters. Now remember, Moody said something about Death Eaters in the previous chapters while looking in the general direction of Snape's office. Moody also seems not to trust Snape. And so we're learning more and we're getting more evidence that Snape doesn't seem like he's just a bad guy who hates Harry. But was maybe in the same crowd of people who were following Voldemort. And Sirius says that he can't really see Dumbledore letting Snape teach if he had ever been a Death Eater. Which brings me back to the question I posed at the beginning of this episode, is whose judgment do you trust more? And maybe we can tie this into the theme of our previous episode about second chances. You know, what did Snape do to need a second chance? But also, what did Snape do to deserve a second chance? And do you trust Dumbledore's judgment on Snape? Do you think Snape, you know, should be teaching potions at Hogwarts if he did something really bad previously? Do you think Moody is right and Dumbledore's just being naive because he's Dumbledore and he likes to be, you know, he likes to be nice to people and accept people? What do you think? I'd love to know all of your thoughts, and you can email me at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com or connect with me on social media on Twitter or Instagram at firstyearspod. For next episode, you just need to read chapters 28 and 29, and I will see you guys next time. Thank you. First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.